Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 48 of Game On with Cody and John.
This is Game On with Cody and John, the uncommon podcast for the common gamer. Bringing you the latest and greatest from the world of tabletop gaming, board games, card games, RPGs, and miniatures wargaming. News and discussions on gaming and gamer culture, plus reviews of some of the best games on the market. And now, from the Game On Studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, here are Cody Jones and John Richard.
Well, howdy gamers, it is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop games coming to you from the beautiful gaming capital of the world, Indianapolis, Indiana.
The countdown to Gen Con is on.
We are kind of mid-conventions between Origins and Gen Con, and we're only just a few weeks away.
I'm excited. I've got my schedule ready. I'm kind of getting my dealer hall strategies in place, and it's going to be a good show, I think.
This is by far the most exciting time for us in Indianapolis. It's the summertime when we can get ready for Gen Con. We love telling you guys about it, and we're going to probably be prattling on a little
bit
this episode about what's coming up for Gen Con. But we also are going to be talking about some other things. Cody, what's our big deal topic?
Oh, we're going to talk about collectible games. And even me saying that probably prickled the hairs on some of your necks out there.
The fingers were going to the stop button on the iPod.
But bear with us. We're going to talk about the stigma behind some of these games, why some gamers won't play it, and just a general discussion on it. I think we can get some interesting things here.
That's right. There's some bad juju when it comes to collectible games in our hobby, but we're gonna kind of just talk. We have a little therapy session about collectible things.
So. And we're going to discuss a game that's very much not collectible in Founding Fathers.
That's right. This was the extreme new hotness from Origins 2010, and I don't even think this thing's hit the street yet. So it's going to
hit the street
yet.
You want some Founding Fathers?
It's like a nice watch. but this game from Jolly Rogers Games and designed by the same guys that did Campaign Manager 2008 and 1960 Making of the President, another great American history game, and we'll be giving you a full review of that one. But as always, we're going to start off with the Game On Inbox, which begins
verily.
The Game On Inbox.
Send us an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Do it.
All right, welcome to the Game On Inbox. We've got a full lid of stuff, as they would say on West Wing.
That's right.
It's a full lid, CJ.
Exactly.
But first, John is going to tell you all about our great sponsor, Myriad Games.
If you listen to this show at all for the last, how long has Myriad been our sponsor?
Decades.
It seems like decades, but it's a good thing. We are sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere, and lots of good things going on at Myriad Games right now. Well, one thing being that they've just opened up a second location. Yeah. That's a big thing for like a small business that's open, a single game store. They're not a huge chain or anything. Yeah. And they've put together a store in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Live free or die. And New Hampshire, small state.
Yeah. Yeah. How far away are those two cities?
Oh, I don't know.
Listeners, Google map that right now.
Yeah.
But, they're pretty close to each other. But meeting all the needs of New Hampshire.
That's right.
And also meeting needs of folks all over the country and or the world through MyriadGames.com, through the GameShare program, and lots of other great stuff. You can always check out their podcasts, Myriad Games presentations on iTunes, and all that great stuff. So we can't say enough good things about Myriad Games. They're not just our sponsor. We really do feel like they're our friend in the gaming business.
That's right. So visit them at Manchester.
Do it. All right, let's move on to games that we've been playing. Cody?
Played a few games. Most notably, I finally got my copy of Talisman the Dungeon to the table.
Mm.
Now, Talisman tends to be a love-hate game. It's most people that love it firstly on the idea of nostalgia, which is where I come in. It was one of the first gamer games I played when I was getting into the hobby. So when the new edition came out, I jumped on it, and I finally started to get the expansions that Fantasy Flight has been putting out. We got to play a four-player game with the dungeon expansion, and it was a lot of fun. I remember playing the old kind of second edition Talisman with some of the expansions there, and they've really done a good job of mixing in things that would happen on the main board with what would happen on the dungeon board. It kind of used to feel in second edition Talisman like if you went on one of the sideboards, city, timescape, dungeon, whatever. That's all you did, and it's like you were playing a different board game than everyone else.
Yeah, you're just kind of stuck over there.
Yeah, but they've really done a good job of of integrating it with the main board so it doesn't feel like you're just playing a mini game within a larger game. So
it doesn't change the overall goal of the game. You're still trying to get the Crown of Command, right?
Yep. Okay. The dungeon gives you an option. If you can get through it, you fight the Lord of Darkness at the end of the dungeon.
Ooh.
And he has Strength 12 and Craft 12, which is pretty high in Talisman. If you beat him, you get to pick something from his treasure pile, and they're really good items for you to use. And if your margin of victory, depending on your margin of victory, you get teleported somewhere on the main board.
Huh.
So if you beat him by, I think it's like 8 or more, you get teleported to the Crown of Command directly.
Oh, nice.
And then as it goes down, it's kind of farther out from the inner region. But so if you just become this monster in the dungeon and go in and kick the crap out of him, you can go to the Crown of Command and go that way. So it's kind of an alternate way to win.
That's cool. Now here's the real question.
Uh-huh.
How long did this game take?
2.5 hours with 4 players in the dungeon.
Not bad.
No,
not bad at all.
Yeah. I've always said, you know, people kind of like to complain about the length of Talisman. If everyone is focusing on the goal, it really doesn't take that long. Yeah, there's some luck things that can throw you off, and yeah, it's a very luck-based game, and I know a lot of people hate it. That's fine. But if everyone's still going toward that goal, you know, I think if you're not screwing around, I mean, I know when I played it as a kid, you know, it's like I would have an elf and chase a guy around the board to shoot him, you know, I wouldn't go for the goal or anything. It's interesting because I noted it when we played, it's like the first half of the game, you know, people are building up strength, and then you see when one person starts to make a run for the middle,
uh-huh.
and the whole game changes. Everyone's like, oh crap, I gotta get moving, you know.
Oh wow.
So it was a fun game, and I'm actually planning on picking up some of the other expansions to Talisman, so we'll see if it makes it bloated or if it's a pretty good experience.
I'd like to play that one again. I haven't played Talisman with you in, gosh, 3 or 4 years.
Oh, yeah,
probably.
It's been a while.
Yeah. Yeah, so I have to get that to the table.
It's a nice, light, fun game.
Anything else?
That's been the majority of it. I've played a few games. Went to my in-laws for the 4th of July. We played games. Kingsburg was a popular one. Played some Hawaiian Rummy, the local card game I told you about.
Mm-hmm.
But Talisman Dungeon was the one that stuck with me the most. So.
Okay. You played a little bit of War Machine, right?
Yeah, that's true. I'd forgotten all about that. Last Friday, a couple of my buddies and I, we played some games of War Machine. We played a few quick skirmish games, 15-point things, just to see how it worked now that we had a lot of options, and
yeah,
that was a lot of fun. And we've played some Magic as well, which we'll discuss a little later.
Kind of prompted our topic,
yeah,
didn't it?
Yeah, we all dusted off Magic. We hadn't played it in years, really, and gave it a whirl, and it was interesting responses, to say the least.
Okay, excellent. Well, we'll be talking about that.
What have you been playing?
I've played quite a bit of stuff with my kids lately. You know, I got back from Origins, and so I do have a pretty good pile of things that I need to kind of get off of the unplayed list, and some of you will be hearing about some of those upcoming in future episodes. But, you know, one of the games I mentioned quite a bit in the Origins wrap-up was this game called Walkstar, which is a cooperative game about running a Chinese restaurant. I decided to give this one a try with my two children, and, you know, I've got the 7-year-old boy and the 4-year-old girl, and the game, I think, is listed as being for 10 and up, something like that. But one of the things that the designer, Tim Fowler, when I talked to him, kind of emphasized was the fact that it was kind of a family-oriented game. I mean, you play a family, a Chinese family that runs this restaurant. And so even though, you know, my two kids are much younger than the age that the game is appropriate for, I was able to make some modifications that made it fun. And I would even say that for an entry into the cooperative game idea, this may be the ideal game to get young kids in the pool as far as that goes. Because the concept of running a restaurant, being in charge of recipes, being in charge of ingredients, and then meeting customers' needs, that, I mean, even a 4-year-old can completely understand that, you know, and understand that, oh, I'm in charge of fried rice and I need these ingredients. So we basically just played through a turn with no timers and, you know, and we rolled the dice and we allocated the resources and all that kind of stuff. And it went really well. And even though it wasn't like, you know, it felt more like an activity than an actual game,
yeah,
I guess, but they got to the end of it and we felt like we'd accomplished something because we served all the customers. And so that was a lot of fun too. I guess it was fun for Ethan too, because he loved the fact that there were a lot of dice in the game and he just kept flicking them off the table.
Good man.
I was like, I need to get him a different, get him a dexterity game or something.
Get him a dice tower or a dice tray.
Oh, maybe so. Yeah. That'd be a good idea. So we played the Walkstar. I've also got a chance to play the new the brand new out of the box game Pirate versus Pirate with both of my kids. And this is a game that we may do a bonus review in the future on this one, because it's definitely worth it. And Cody hasn't had a chance to play yet.
I hear it's very different from Ninja versus Ninja. It's not just a retheming.
Yeah, it's got the same idea of you roll dice and you move your guys, and you have to sort of tactically move them around the board. But in this game, you're trying to get treasure that's in the middle of the board and then take it back to your boat. And the spaces on the board, instead of being squares, they're triangles. And so the way that you have to move is very different. Mm. And so there's some interesting movement rules and rules about, once you've gotten the treasure, what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. This was also a really good one for small kids too, because all you have to do is just roll and move, and you can be real strategic if you want to, or, you know, like my 4-year-old, you can just, you know,
run around.
She's just happy to be able to count the spaces and count the dice, and that's great too. So she had fun and felt engaged in the game as well. So we'll talk about Pirate versus Pirate again once Cody's played it, but I already give this one a thumbs up. Also, going along once again with the stuff I played with my kids, got a game in the Origins math trade called If Wishes Were Fishes. Hmm. And this is a, I want to say this might be a Rio Grande game. I'm not sure. But it's a Euro style game, I guess. It's almost like an economics game where you're getting fish, you're fishing for fish in the ocean, and then you're having to sell these fish at a market that's on the board. And there's 5 different kinds of fish. It's very cartoony. Like, there's the clown fish that looks like Nemo.
Mm-hmm.
There's the monk fish, which has like a cross around his neck and a Bible. And, you know, the king fish and the sword fish with a sword. And so, you know, you're gonna grab these cards to represent your fish, and you can put them in your boat, and you have a maximum of two fish you can put in your boat, and then you take and sell them for a certain amount. But on the markets, there's also these little meeples, and depending on the color meeple and the size of the meeple, you'll get additional points for selling at that market, because it represents a buyer who really wants that fish.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing, though, is that when you take a fish, you can either put it in your boat as a fish, or there's on the card, it's almost like the fish is talking. It's like a word bubble.
Yeah.
And then there's a wish that you can, like a special ability that you can enact immediately. But the cost of that is that you don't get to keep the fish. You have to throw them back, and you throw them to the discard pile. And so these are little rule breakers in the games that allow you to sell different kinds of fish, sell more than one fish, and lots of other different things. So there's some variety in that. It's a really good game for adults. I mean, I think that you could have a lot of fun with that with just a group of adults. But the fact that it has that sort of cartoony, fishy theme, and there's not too many things that you have to do on your turn, the kids really, really enjoyed that one. The best part is that the game comes with these, they're basically like gummy worms. They're these big purple, like, rubber worms.
Yeah.
And so when you get a fish, you have 4 cards that are face up to represent what's in the water. If you take the one that's farthest away from the deck, then that's free. But if on your turn you decide to take the second card, then you have to put a worm on the first card. If you take the third card, you have to put a worm on the first 2 cards. You know? And the idea being that, you know, when you take a card that has worms on it, you get those worms. And then there's a bonus at the end of the game. Whoever has the most worms gets 8 additional points.
Oh, okay.
So that can be a little extra game you can play. That my son liked to do that. He loved collecting the worms more than just about anything. But
that sounds fun.
Yeah, that's the fun. We'll have to play that one sometime too. The other thing, and the last thing I'll talk about as far as games I've been playing, is the new hotness from Fantasy Flight, Battles of Westeros, has just been released. And I haven't gotten a chance to play it yet. As a matter of fact, when we get done recording this show, Cody and I are going to go and play.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
That's a big old box.
Yeah. And so what I've done this past weekend is I spent this time basically doing prep work on the game. So I punched out all the cardboard and that kind of stuff. And then the big work in the game, and we'll talk about this when we review it, is that you need to assemble the miniatures, and you have to actually take the little miniatures and put them into the bases. And I'll just tell you right now, if you're planning on getting this game, you need to get some glue.
Oh,
and the glue is just a requirement for this, because, you know, they don't fit into those bases very well, and you're going to want to reinforce those with some glue, or they'll be popping out every single time. So that might be kind of a downside, kind of a deny point maybe for folks who aren't miniatures gamers at all, or aren't interested in having to do a little bit of prep work on the pieces to the game. But don't have a verdict in the game yet, but boy, the pieces are just really cool, and all the components and the rules look really neat. So stay tuned on that one.
All right, we got a an email and a voicemail. We've got a pretty lean inbox here, but we're going to.
That's right. What are you guys doing out there?
Seriously,
you got to write us and call us.
All right. First of all, we have an email from Brian Smith, and he writes, "Dear Cody and John, first of all, I'm sorry that I was never able to spot John at this year's Origins and say hello, and I even missed out on getting a button.
Oh, I'm sorry, man.
And he's hard to miss, too.
If you come to Gen Con and you find me, I'll give you a button.
Yeah. But I also had a few thoughts about the rearrangement events that John described. John's two examples were the relocations of the big experiment to a larger first-floor meeting room and of the boardroom to one side of the large conference hall. My suspicion is that this was how Origins planners reacted to last year's sharp drop in attendance, likely caused by the cratering economy." I would say that and their poor planning.
Their poor marketing and planning.
They may have wanted the event to have a smaller footprint in order to maintain the density of the crowd and try to keep a busy, intimate feeling for the con as a whole. Apparently, the attendance made up some lost ground this year. May it continue to do so in the future. And if the planners really were trying to keep up a bustling atmosphere by moving events around a bit, I think it worked nicely. Thanks, and I hope I can catch up with you next year, Brian Smith.
Yeah, thanks for the email, Brian. Yeah, I kind of agree with you, I guess.
That's an interesting theory.
It's really hard to tell because with Origins, it just never feels crowded to me. Even in the dealer hall, it just never feels that crowded. So,
yeah.
But, you know, having those events like the big experiment downstairs, it at least made it very visible. So you had a lot of like onlookers that were looking and saying, what's going on in that room, you know? And, you know, like we didn't even mention this on our show, but like in the Mayfair booth, they had one of those Microsoft Surface tables where they were playing Catan on that. And that was down in that sort of another one of those sort of open areas. So it gave a sort of a gamery fun feel to having it all down there.
I it's plausible that they'd want, you know, to increase the foot traffic and make it seem busier than it was.
Yeah.
But I'm with you. One of the things I really like about Origins is that it's just so laid back and spread out and just very casual. So
you just don't, like we said before, you just don't feel like you're, as you're sitting playing a game, that you're missing a thousand other things. You can really relax and play.
Yeah.
And he mentioned that apparently the attendance made up some lost ground. Yeah, according to the official numbers, I guess they had 5% more than last year. They're saying that it was around 10,500, 10,600 that came, and that it was around 10,000 last year. So.
And just think what it would have been. I'm not trying to gripe, but just think what it would have been if they would have had all their ducks in a row with hotel and pre-reg and everything.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully the success of this year will make the planners of Origins look and say, wow, if we really have our act together next year, this thing could really explode and be even better.
So. Yeah, hopefully it's not the other effect where it's like, oh, you know, we...
rest on our laurels.
Yeah, you know, really slapped it together the last minute. We still got an increase, so
I'm going back to Tahiti.
Yeah, exactly. So let's hope Origins continues to grow because it's quite a lot of fun.
It's good con.
We've got one other. We have a voicemail.
Yay!
And from the beautiful town of Bloomington, Indiana,
beautiful
home of Indiana University. Go Hoosiers!
I guess.
Hey guys, my name is Ben Correll. Come from Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, I just wanted to comment on the whole trick-taking games all over the United States. And beyond, I guess. Anyway, I just had a comment. We had friends. We were talking about Euchre, and I'm from Michigan originally, and loved playing Euchre up in Michigan. And they had no idea what I was talking about. They're from Mississippi, and then I started describing it to them, and they said, "Oh, Boorang," and they had a completely different name for it. And it was the exact same game. It was Euchre. I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting cultural thing. I'll talk to you guys later. Bye.
Boorang.
Boorang.
he delivered that very well.
That was nice. Yeah. I've never heard of
Boorang
before. But okay, that's cool. You know, I think that really lends credence to what we were talking about how these regional card games,
there's probably only really five games in the United States, but there's 300 different names of it.
Exactly.
Thank you for the voicemail. Very cool.
We used to play this game called chess, but it was actually Euchre.
We call it TikTok.
All right. So thanks for that voicemail, Ben.
We got a little bit of gaming news. John's got some tidbits.
We do have a few tidbits and
nuggets.
A couple of nuggets. Yeah. The first one is from game maker Wizards of the Coast. Their Avalon Hill board game. Unit, I guess.
I was surprised to hear it was still going on.
Yeah, and recently some of the games that have come out of Avalon Hill, like the reprint of Acquire and especially the reprint of Diplomacy, not that impressive, really, in my opinion, as far as components and things like that. But you can't argue about Diplomacy's rules. They're awesome.
Yeah.
But they're going to be releasing a couple of games that I think are pretty highly sought after right now that have been out of print. And those are Betrayal and House on the Hill. And this is a game that if you look on eBay right now, the copies of that from the original publisher are going for upwards of $100 to $150.
Yeah, if you've got it, sell it now.
Yeah, really, because it's about to get the market's about to get flooded. But yeah, so this is a kind of a cool kind of pseudo cooperative. Is it cooperative style? I've never played it. I've never played it either. Yeah, but it's got a cool horror theme to it.
I think it's got a traitor element to it. I might be talking out of my butt here, but I think it's like cooperative with a traitor element to it.
Yeah, we're podcasting professionals. That's right. And experts in the gaming world.
We run a gaming podcast.
The other game is Battle Cry, which is Richard Borg's first game in the Commands and Colors series. You know, the series includes Commands and Colors Ancients, Battle Lore, and actually sort of the Battles of Westeros that we're going to be talking about in a couple episodes. But yeah, so Battle Cry is the Civil War themed version of this game. And the, you know,
or War Between the States if you're from the South, the War of Northern Aggression,
exactly,
whatever you want to call it.
But you know, so this looks like this is going to be a lot of fun too. Now, you know, one of the draws of a game like Battle Lore or Memoir 44, I forgot to mention, that's the other big one that's in that series.
It's a little bit popular.
Yeah, a little bit. Is the great components and the cool miniatures and, you know, the little tanks and stuff like that. So I'll be interested to see what Avalon Hill does with Battle Cry, if they're going to have actual miniatures of, you know, guys on horseback and things like that. But you can't argue with the system. Richard Borg really put together a cool system with Commands and Colors. So check those out from Avalon Hill. I think both those games are coming out sometime in the fall. Now, here's one other little piece of news that I haven't even told Cody about, because I wanted to get his reaction on the actual recording here. And apparently a very timely board game has cropped up and has gotten a lot of press lately on BoardGameGeek. I don't know if you saw it.
Maybe.
But there is actually a game that was published in the 1970s called BP Offshore Oil Strike.
Oh, yes.
Did you hear about this?
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a game, I guess, that was published in the 70s, real obscure and rare, and it's about the exciting world of drilling oil. It says, the thrills of drilling, the hazards and rewards as you bring in your own offshore oil strike. And yeah, so that's kind of sad. And like the point of the game is to be the first player to earn $120 million. And you know, there's even things in there like hazard cards, things like, you know, blowout, rig damage, oil slick cleanup costs, pay $1 million. Like, truth is stranger than fiction. Yeah, that is odd. So that's just kind of funny. So you can definitely go on BoardGameGeek, and under the hot games right now on the left side, you can find Offshore Oil Strike and go and, you know, see some pictures and stuff of that.
You know, we're talking about websites.
Oh, yeah.
And
good segue, Cody.
Thank you. I'm a podcasting professional.
Go ahead.
We've kind of revamped things at GameOnPodcast.com, our home on the web.
Yeah.
We've kind of simplified, streamlined a little bit. And
this is kind of GameOn 2.5, right, yeah, as far as the website goes. Yeah.
But we have a new website out there, which we'd like all of you to check out and give your feedback on. Like I said, we're just trying to go. We're the uncommon podcast for the common gamer, and we're just trying to keep it simple and fulfill our mission, I guess.
Exactly. We liked the graphical look of the last website, but we just wanted to simplify things and make it easier to find. You know, the main content on the site is our show. You know, but we've got a couple of other things on there. We want to make it real easy for you to find the Board Game Geek Guild, to be able to subscribe. You know, and send your friends to subscribe. You know, donation button, things like that. Hopefully, you'll like the look of it. So we'd love any feedback that you have on the website. Sure. And how can they get a hold of us if they want to get a hold of us for things like that?
Well, one of the two best ways would be the GameOn inbox.
That's GameOnInbox@gmail.com.
That's how you can reach us via email. And we also have, as you heard earlier, the GameOn hotline.
That's 4138-GAME-ON or 413-842-6366.
Well, it just sounded like you were adding numbers there.
I just making stuff
3811X Batman symbol.
Bingo.
Yes.
So yeah, those are the best ways that you can get a hold of us. And so just to kind of close out the game on inbox, we want to talk a little bit about Gen Con.
We're going
to
geek out a little bit.
Geek out just a little bit. Yeah. Our next episode, we'll go ahead and just tell you, is going to be delayed 1 week. Normally have a 2 week time frame between our shows. This is going to be 3 weeks because we want to have plenty of time to Get ready for Gen Con, to go to Gen Con, and then we'll be releasing our Gen Con episode.
Yeah.
So we wanted to talk about what we're going to be doing at the convention this year and what kind of stuff we've got going on. So, Cody, why don't you kind of just give us a rundown of what your schedule is at Gen Con this year?
Okay. I am blessed to have the whole week off this year.
Nice.
I'm not sure what I'm really going to do Monday or most of Tuesday, but I know a lot of my friends that I've met through the Gen Con forums and through the con itself, they'll be coming in Tuesday night, so we'll probably go to Scotty's Brew House or one of the local bars, restaurants, just kind of hang out, play some games, you know, visit up. Wednesday, which I consider the actual first day of the con. Gen Con calls itself the best 4 days in gaming. It's the best 5 days in gaming. Yeah. Wednesday, the Kentucky Fried Gamers, the KFG, they run their typical Wednesday gaming slew of games. You've got things from second edition D&D to Arkham Horror to Descent to the Hollow Earth Expedition role-playing game, all sorts of things going on in hotels and restaurant locations around the city.
Yeah. It's grown quite a bit over the years. We first got involved in the KFG, what is it, like 4 or 5 years ago now? And they used to have just a little bit of gaming in the back room of the Ram Brewery and Restaurant. And now it's exploded. It really has.
And you can actually check out their Wednesday gaming schedule online at wednesdaygaming.com.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't even know about that.
Yeah, they are... they're really stretching out. And you can also go to KentuckyFriedGamers.com to learn more about the group, which is just a bunch of good old boys that are getting together and hosting some gaming events.
That's right. If you have any redneck roots whatsoever, or if you know anybody who has redneck roots, or if you've ever seen a redneck in Walmart or something, then you qualify.
That's right. So check them out. Great group of folks, and they take walk-ups, as it were. So
nice.
If you're in town Wednesday, come on and join them. So that's my Wednesday. How much of my schedule do you want?
Oh, okay. Well, you talk about your Wednesday. I'll talk about my Wednesday. Wednesday, I'll be at work.
All right.
Because I only am able to get Thursday and Friday off of the week of Gen Con.
Sucker.
But now, you know, it's local, so I don't feel too bad about it. But yeah, so Wednesday I'm going to be doing that. And then Wednesday evening, I'm actually going to be hosting a fellow podcaster as a guest in my home. And Mr. Tom Vassell, from formerly of South Korea, now of Homestead, Florida, is going to be coming in for Gen Con for a couple of days. I hope that wasn't a secret, Tom, because I'm telling everybody. But he's coming in for a couple of days for Gen Con, and he's going to be spend the night at my house, and hopefully Cody and I can we don't have any plans really, but you know, we'll do whatever Tom wants to do, because he's never been to Indy or he's never been to Gen Con before, so we'll maybe play some games or do something like that.
Yeah, Merchant of Venus. Yeah, we can play that.
I don't have a copy of that. No. Eric Summer, if you want to send me your copy of Merchant of Venus, we'll try to get into the table with Tom. So what about Thursday?
The majority of Thursday, probably the morning and early afternoon, will be just, you know, taking in the show, hitting the dealer's hall for the first of many times, and, I don't know, just kind of getting my bearings and all that. But around 3-ish, 3:45, I think?
3:48,
3:48,
sorry. 3:48, don't be late.
No, I won't. We have the first of two True Dungeon runs that I'm doing this year, and it is a podcaster True Dungeon run.
It's going to be so much fun.
Yeah, we've gathered some of our friends in the... In the business, as
in
it were.
The biz.
And we're going to... only John and I... Oh, and Wayne.
And Wayne, our voiceover guy, yeah.
Have been to True Dungeon before. The rest of them, completely new experience, and I'm really excited to see what they think of it.
Yeah, part of the fun will be doing True Dungeon, because it's a blast.
Mm-hmm.
But really, part of the fun for us is going to be watching them do True Dungeon.
Yes.
So we've got the three of us, me, Cody, and Wayne. We've got Tom Vassell will be joining us, playing our resident barbarian.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've also got Russ Wakelin from the D6 Generation, Nicole Wakelin, his wife, a total fangirl from the D6 Generation. We've got Dan and Sarah Yerrington from Myriad Games. They're going to be joining us as well.
Yeah, they're going to have a blast.
It's going to be a great time.
The one bad thing about True Dungeon is no tavern this year.
They
usually have their cool fantasy tavern. They axed it in favor of something else.
So wait, what are they going to dump out? Because you usually kind of come out of the True Dungeon, you finish the last room, and then you dump into the tavern, basically.
I don't know. I guess you just come out into the Marriott.
Yeah. Oh, and we're back in a hotel.
Yeah. So that'll be a downer. I really hope they bring that back next year, but we can only hope. I mean, it's a cool place to hang out and play games. And heck, I proposed to Kaylin there. So
that's true.
So it's cool.
Thanks, Jeff Martin, for taking away that special place for Cody. Just kidding, Jeff.
Do you have anything else you're doing Thursday?
No, mainly I'm going to be doing the dealer hall stuff on, mm-hmm. on Thursday. I like to take the first day when it's not too terribly, it's pretty crowded, but you know, it's not as crowded as a Saturday,
oh, yeah.
to look around, go from one end of the dealer hall all the way to the other, just walk through the aisles, see all the cool stuff.
Window shows.
Yeah,
take
play
your
some.
Time.
And I'm sure there'll probably be a couple of hot items that I don't know at this point what those will be, but you know, I might be running into the dealer hall at 10 a.m. to buy something.
Yeah.
But after that, just be looking around and then doing True Dungeons. That's all I got for Thursday.
Yeah, the one other event I have on Thursday is actually, it's a LARP. It's from 9 p.m. to midnight or 1 a.m. It's pretty late. It's by a group I have several friends in called BYOV, which stands for Bring Your Own Vegetable, which doesn't help explain the group any better.
I don't even know what that means. I'm not supposed to know what it means, right?
I think that's the trick. I don't know what it means.
Okay.
But they put on kind of systemless LARPs, and they do a range of topics. They do, like, they've done Harry Potter LARPs. They've done... you know, fairy-based LARPs. And they do all sorts of things in between. But they had one this year that really sparked my interest. It's called The Seven. And the idea is that all of the players are kind of important historical figures. They haven't put out a list yet, but you know, important historical figures. And they're kind of meeting for this party. And the Seven are the seven very unique historical figures that are cryogenically frozen all year, but they kind of come out for a New Year's party and pick the next member of their club to join them for supposed immortality.
That's very strange.
Yeah, it's out there. But what's cool about the BYOV LARPs is you have your character and, you know, they list your motivations and your goals, and pretty much all of them have some sort of secret agenda that involves either getting someone to help them or screwing someone, or, you know, just it's very character driven, and it sounds pretty crazy, but they put on a good show, and it's a good game without kind of the drama you get with some LARPs. And it's like, I attack you. You know, there's no combat or anything.
It's not like a buffer LARP
with
swords or
no,
anything.
Purely okay. social, and you get bonus points for dressing up. So,
which you probably will be.
I got
you?
The tux. I'll bust it out.
Very nice. Now, are you going to be wearing your bard costume at some point during the week?
I really don't think so.
Okay.
I've got a... Kaylin and I both have kind of the Ren Faire type costumes, and I usually play Bard for True Dungeon, so I've got this whole getup. But without the tavern, I don't know. It just...
Yeah, even for the run, the True Dungeon
run? I don't know. I'd be the only one in costume, so...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Probably okay. not.
Well, that's
sorry, okay. that's a downer.
That's okay. I was kind of looking forward to it now. Well, Thursday for me... we talked about Thursday.
Friday.
Friday. Let's move on to Friday.
Yeah. Well, we'll both be at the Pulp Gamer Media Network Live panel.
Yeah.
At, from 10 to 11 a.m. If you want to meet us, if you want to meet the Myriad folks, D6G, Pulp Gamer, the whole lineup.
They should be there. Yeah.
They should be there. So stop by then and
come say hi to us.
It's free. Come say hi.
That's right.
Yep.
And I don't have much else going on until a little bit later in the afternoon. There's another seminar called The Latest and Greatest in Board and Card Games. That's kind of another sort of podcaster-run seminar. And I think I'm going to be on that panel. I can't remember if I'm just attending it or if I'm going to be on the panel or not. And if I am on the panel, we'll be talking about the newest board and card yeah. games. I'm real, real prepared.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah. But then for me, just mainly more dealer hall. After... One of my tactics, I guess, in scheduling stuff for Gen Con is I like to try to keep as much of the middle of the day when the dealer hall's open, you know, and that's from 10 to 6 on most days, just because I want to get the maximum amount of time to play demos and to experience, you know, the dealer hall is one of the biggest deals of Gen Con is being able to go in there. So then I like to schedule games and events after it closes. And so on that particular day I have on Friday, I have a demo of the game Malifaux, which is from Weird Miniatures. And here it comes. Cody's giving me the look. I'm not necessarily interested in getting into another miniatures game, but if I were, this one might be the game because it's such a small number of models, much like War Machine, that it wouldn't be much of an investment to put together. I think even on my own, I might be able to put together two crews. I think that's what they call them instead of war bands or whatever, to be able to play a game. So I'm going to do a demo of that and... yeah, so that's Friday. What else you got?
The only other thing I'm doing is at 10 p.m. I'm doing a demo of the I forget what the actual title is. It's the Castle Ravenloft board game that Wizards of the Coast is putting out.
Oh, you know what? I just scrolled down on my I'm doing that too.
Oh, hey, cool.
I'm in that too.
I didn't know that. Awesome.
Oh, yeah, cool.
It's from everything I've seen about it, it basically looks a lot like Descent.
Okay.
But with the D&D kind of Ravenloft theme attached to it. So I'm a little wary, but we'll see. You know, it looks like just kind of a clone of Descent. But
okay.
It's D&D and I like the Ravenloft setting, so I'll give it a whirl.
Sounds good. How about Saturday?
Saturday, I have tickets to a Fantasy Flight Games secret event.
Ooh.
At 10 a.m. where they're going to be doing a demo and a full game. It's a four-hour slot of their next new hotness game.
You don't know what it is yet?
No idea what it is. It could be. It's probably Warhammer something related.
Probably so these days.
Yeah, or My Little Pony. I don't know. But
My Little Pony CCG.
no idea what's going to be that. But directly from there, I'm running back over to the Marriott and doing the other True Dungeon, the puzzle run with my family. So we always do a big run, and that should be pretty interesting. So I get to do both True Dungeon runs this year.
Very cool. For Saturday, for me, I'm actually at 9 o'clock playing in a big 4.5-hour game of Descent Sea of Blood.
Ooh.
And I actually was traded in the Origins Math Trade and got a copy, a brand new copy of Descent Sea of Blood. And I've played the Road to Legend campaign setting, and I really am interested in the flavor of this Sea of Blood campaign. So I'm going to play in this game, and hopefully that'll give me an idea for whether that's something I want to run or if I want to switch over my Road to Legend campaign to Sea of Blood.
Yeah.
A little more dealer time there. And then Saturday afternoon at 4, I have my last of three podcasting panels. This one I'm actually going to be, I think, if I'm not leading it, then I'm definitely co-leading it, and that's on podcasting gear and gadgets. I did this seminar last year with Russ Wakeland from the D6 Generation, where we just talk about things like microphones and all the hardware and stuff that goes into putting on a podcast. So if you're interested in podcasting at all, please come and check it out.
Yeah, definitely, because John knows his stuff. The reason this show sounds so good is 100% on him. Because I just make the logo and I just show up and talk. So
you're the reason why it looks so good.
Well, there we go.
I'm just the reason why it sounds good.
But if you're interested at all in the equipment, John and Russ will get you taken care of. And to wrap up the evening, I believe we will both be at the media meet and greet.
That's right. At the house, which mm-hmm. is sort of this sort of pseudo bar they put together.
Yeah.
That's in a basement area over near Union Station.
Yep.
And I think Don Dem and the Pulp Gamer folks have put together this huge meeting of game publishers and podcasters and fans. And, you know, feel free to come down and
it's check real it casual. Out. Grab a drink and come say hi.
Yeah, it's really cool. And then that leaves us with the very last day, Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do on Sunday?
Sunday, I started this last year, and I think I'm going to try it again. There is a group. It's the Christian Gaming Guild. They put on a non-denominational worship service at Gen Con. It's real casual, just real informal. There's a message, some singing, communion. But it's just really neat to kind of see that camaraderie with other gamers, because you're seeing people from not only across the nation, but from around the world that have come together sharing both, not just the love of a hobby, but the same faith as well. So that was a really neat experience and kind of touched my heart a little bit last year. So I'll be there again this
year.
Very
cool. Any other events for you on Sunday?
Yeah, I'm going to try and get into the Harry's Grand Slam Baseball Tournament.
Tournament of Champions.
I don't know how you do a tournament with that game, but at 11 a.m. out of the box, our good friends there are putting that on, so I figured, why the heck not? I'll give it a whirl.
Yeah, well, I'll have to give you some practice games to get you all ready, get you all limbered up.
Strike out.
Strike a ground out. You know, Sunday, I don't actually have any events scheduled. I actually, my church that I attend is in downtown Indianapolis, just a few blocks from the convention center, actually. And I'm the sound guy and audio engineer at the church. So I will actually be there for the first half of the day on Sunday. But usually I like to try to make it in for one last sweep of the dealer hall before it closes at 4. And last year, when the game Arcane Legions was being demoed quite a bit, I won one of their giant 4x6-foot tabletops. So I spent the last half of Gen Con trying to get a pickup truck to take that back to my house. So, and in my garage, it still sits. But yeah, so I usually try to take it easy. And, you know, by about 3 or 4 o'clock, it's time to just exhale and begin the long, slow decline into depression that happens after Gen Con every year. So that's what I got for Gen Con. Well, you got anything else going on, or is that
no,
pretty much your convention?
No, just to kind of reiterate about Sunday, if you're looking for a good deal, if there's an item that you know, maybe is not an instant buy or something that's going to sell out, you can sometimes get a deal because some publishers or vendors, they don't want to take a lot of stuff back with them.
Yeah, I agree. And you may find that even that non-American publishers that you know, maybe would have to ship their product back to Europe, that they're very much interested in unloading that product before they leave. So that might be a good opportunity to get some good loot.
Yep.
All right, so we're real excited about Gen Con. It's going to be a great show, and we look forward to seeing you there. If you see us in our Game On attire, we'll have our bowling shirts on at least a couple of days until they start smelling bad. Feel free to come up to us and say hi, and we would love to talk to you. So I think that about wraps up the Game On inbox.
Yeah, I think we should get our collectible hats on and look into the big deal.
Let's do it. The big deal.
As far as deals go, this one's pretty big.
Well, welcome to The Big Deal. After a couple of episodes of sort of non-traditional, non-normal big deals, we're going to have a good old-fashioned big deal discussion.
A throwdown.
It's time to pull out a good topic and just talk about it for a little bit. And the origin of this topic is some of the games we've been playing lately. We've dusted off a game that neither of us have played very much of in the last few years, but one that is very near and dear to both of our hearts, and that's Magic the Gathering. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's really the game for me that got me into gaming. Now, D&D got you into gaming, right?
Actually, no. Magic was the first, I guess, gamer game.
Oh, okay.
And then through Magic, I met the people I met through Magic played D&D, and that's how I got into that. And,
oh, okay. I didn't know. It's the other way around. Yep. So, actually, it was Magic first. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, that's the game that got us both into gaming. And it's a great game. It's really a great game. I just love the game. Mm-hmm. But it has a particular stigma associated with it that we want to talk about a little bit more. And that is the stigma of the collectible game. And there's lots of games out there. We cover a lot of games, board games, card games, role-playing games, all that kind of stuff. But the collectible aspect is always something that I think we tend to shy away from, probably unnecessarily. But I think the reason behind it is because anytime we mention a game that we like that's collectible, the people that, like the friends that I talk to, a lot of them, they just sort of get this look on their face like I've just, you know.
Like you're trying to rope them into a scheme.
Yeah, know? Yeah, exactly. Like you're a solicitor at their door trying to get them to buy something. And so we just wanted to discuss a little bit just sort of the stigma that's associated with collectible games, why that is, and maybe what some companies are doing about it. So, Cody, when you think of games like Magic the Gathering and these other collectible card games, I mean, you know, I know that I sometimes get that same twinge of, I'm not sure if I want to get involved in something like this. So how do you feel about collectible games in general?
Well, I'll kind of preface that with the story of Magic in my gaming group.
Okay.
I got into Magic when I was 7th or 8th grade, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And I learned it actually from some kids in the neighborhood, actually, and through this, some kids.
The ruffians down the street.
Yeah, yeah. Some fellow geeks in the neighborhood. And, you know, I learned that, and then I met some kids through school that played it, you know, friends of ours. And, you know, it just kind of kept growing and growing. We would, even though we played D&D together, we'd always play a few hands of Magic. You know, there'd be an hour or two of Magic, and then we'd play D&D. Mm-hmm. Of course, this is when we played D&D till like 2 or 3 in the morning. And it just kept tended to grow and grow in popularity. We were buying more cards. We were really getting into it. People were starting to buy booster boxes. I mean, it was getting kind of really ramped up. And then kind of right when I was maybe a junior or senior high school, it's like the bottom fell out of it. And I don't even know what happened to it, but it's like people didn't want to have anything to do with it. I guess everyone realized all at once how much money they were spending on it.
Uh-huh.
And they're just saying, no, forget it. We're not going to do it. And we didn't play for years.
Wow.
And just now we're kind of starting to get back into it. And I guess I say that to answer your question. I feel like it's almost like playing with fire. I guess I'm trying to not think of it that way. But my first impression is a guarded one. I'm like, you know, it could be a really good game, you know, Magic, really good game.
Yeah.
But I always feel like, A, I'm not going to get the whole experience if I don't stay current with it. and B, that it will never be worth the money that I sink into it.
And maybe that's the one first thing, you know, it's kind of a aspect of these games we can, you know, bring up and talk about, is that these games tend to, I guess, appeal to a bit of an addictive side to some people's personality. And I'm not talking about, you know, addictive to the point of ruin, but right. But that, you know, if you happen to be the kind of person that would play World of Warcraft, you know, every day for a month, you know, if you had a chance to or whatever, that, you know, those kind of temptations we have to really get involved in something and go overboard in it, I think these kind of games really draw you into that more than other games. You know, I don't see too many people saying, oh my gosh, when the next Carcassonne expansion comes out, I gotta get that. I gotta get it. When's it coming out?
A real problem.
Exactly. But, you know, with these kind of games, the marketing model is such that it's almost like a drug, you know, that it's really, they're trying to give you just enough to understand the mechanics and get interested in the game, but not enough to really give you, like you said, the full experience.
Yeah, and not to sound too back in my day, but you know, Wizards even changed the expansion schedule of release, because it kind of used to be, I think, as few as 2 expansions a year and a core set.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may have had, you know, 6 months between expansions, and now I think it's like every 2 months something new is coming out in the expansion realm. And, you know, just the way, if you want to stay current on the tournament scene, or, you know, the events they have set up, you have to have a current deck. So it seems like almost every, you know, 9 to 12 months, you have to do a complete overhaul of your collection to and redo your deck to make sure that it meets these standards.
And when we talk about tournament scene, there is a real official like tournament scene with like the pro tour and people who do this for a living. But even if you're just playing Friday Night Magic at your local game store, just to stay current with that, which is like almost kind of a semi-casual form of play, you still have to keep up with it, because after a while, those particular those sets blocks. Cycle out. Those blocks will cycle out of being, you know, part of the accepted group that you can build a deck with. So that's kind of a drawback, you know.
Yeah.
An
argument that some people will come up with is, you know, they have a legacy format, and they have formats that support the older cards.
Yeah.
I'll grant you that, but I would say 75% of the events are for this, you know, the standard block or the modern block, whatever they call it these days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the legacy events may come around eventually, but the lion's share of things I've seen have been the standard or the type 2 or whatever they call it events.
And I think that even if you aren't interested in the tournament scene, one of the difficulties with a game like Magic is that if you're just the kind of person who's a cult of the new kind of person, you know, I tend to be that way with board games. When the new board game comes out, I'm first in line to get it sometimes, depending on the game. With Magic, that is one game, but it's almost like getting, you know, new expansions. It would be like Descent putting out an expansion, you know, every 2 months,
right?
You know, and you just sort of look at it and say, well, look what these cards do. And you know, you look online at the previews of the cards and you're like, oh man, that would go so good with my, and you start to see the possibilities of how you can use this card in this deck that you have and have it interact with other cards. And it's such a living entity that if you really like to get the new stuff, you can really be sucked into it.
Yeah. And one of the things, and this happened with my group, is you get one or two people that stay really current, stay on the bleeding edge of the releases, and they're bringing out stuff in games that, you know, that may not even be more powerful. It's kind of like, in playing again recently, I'm finding that the older stuff matches up with the newer stuff pretty
it's
well.
Fine, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the balance is there. But, you know, they have all these new abilities, and kind of the almost lazy way to look at it is, there's just all these new abilities, I don't know what they do, and they're just moving too fast, and, you know, you just kind of shut yourself out from it.
And
you know, there always seems to be, that's the start of the downfall, is there's the one or two people in the group that, you know, either put in a lot of money or buy a lot of new things and kind of disrupt the waters there.
Oh, and I wonder what exactly is that point, because you put a lot of money into a game. Magic, other than just some adding new abilities, the basics of Magic have not changed in the 17 years that Magic has been around.
Mm-mm.
You know, I mean, you could still pull out put a deck together of alpha set cards and play with the brand new set, and it would be fine.
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, what is it that when you get to that, is it just remorse over having spent so much money? Because, like I said, it seems like the fun of the game should not have really changed.
Yeah. You know? I think, I'm finding nowadays that it's almost like the lack of a group contract or kind of a a shared agreement amongst the people you play with normally. Once there's a really large unbalance there, it can really disrupt things. You know, I think if everyone is saying, hey, you know, let's just make a you know, gentleman's agreement, you know, we're not going to buy more than X, or we'll only play with these cards or what have you, then I think, you know, our group would still be playing it regularly had that happened, you know.
Yeah.
But we had some people buying booster boxes and some people playing with five-year-old cards.
Yeah.
And the people playing with the older cards are saying, like, I don't want to spend the money to get new cards. I still want to play, but, you know, to them it seemed impossible just because they were playing with all these new cards and they had old cards, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'll go you one better with that kind of example is that the group that I used to play with at my last old job with Single L, friend of the podcast, Single L and David, you know, we got really into Magic and we're playing it really regularly. And then Single L decided that he found Magic online and he started playing online and he found that this was a really good way that, you know, when he wasn't playing, because he wanted to play a lot more, you know, when he wasn't able to play at lunch or when we got together, he could always go home and get a game with, you know, someone online.
You can do a draft in your underwear.
Exactly. 3 in the morning. Yeah. And he liked doing the booster drafts and everything. And Magic Online is a great way to play if you like, if, you know, if you're really interested in the play of the game, you know, even more above the sitting down in front of somebody and having to be a social thing. And so when Lloyd got into doing Magic Online, you know, and nothing against him, I mean, that was a okay decision for him, you know, is then none of us really followed suit. I wasn't really interested in really getting involved online, and neither was David so much. It's like our buying habits really changed due to that. So I think that you're absolutely right that when there's that social contract gets broken or gets modified.
Mm-hmm. Or if there's not one.
Or if there's not one, then that's really gonna change things. Just to kind of not change topics, but just talk about another aspect of these collectible games is it seems like we've talked about Magic, but other collectible card games tend to have a hard time sticking in the market. So it's like if you go to Gen Con, you'll notice that there is a whole bunch of booths that sell Magic cards, you know, like third party retailers that are selling, you know, they have cases with the cards and the sleeves and everything, and they'll sell booster boxes and that kind of stuff, and they'll have old cards. But then you'll also see dozens of collectible card games that you've never heard of before, probably. You know, they've made one out of every single TV show and cartoon and whatever that you can think of. But they come out, you know, they're like a flash in the pan and then they're gone. I mean, one of my kind of keepsakes from Gen Con from three or four years ago is I have the starter kit for the 24 collectible card game based upon the 24 television series. And this is only after the show had been on for like 3 or 4 seasons. And you know, it was a huge release at Gen Con. They had a big booth and then of course it was gone the next year. So, to me that makes these kinds of games take a hit as far as my desire to play them, because it almost sort of makes them seem like they're less quality games.
Yeah, it's almost like they're made to make the quick money. You know, like they're not really designed to be in the long haul. I don't know how much, you know, production costs, but you think it's got to be so much cheaper than a board game just to print these cards.
I would imagine.
You know, it's like they may be fine if they have a really good convention season or maybe a really good first year and then it just peters off really quickly.
They made their money,
you know, they might be done. And a lot of it is, you know, cashing in on what's popular at the time. You know, there was a Babylon 5 collectible card game. No one's playing it these days, but, you know, people back then may have played it. You know?
Another example is a game called The Spoils that had a huge presence at Gen Con for a couple of years. Yeah. Kind of an annoying presence, actually. I heard it was a really good game. I never had a chance to play it, but, you know, and just never got that momentum. There's really only been a few collectible card games that have maintained momentum. You know, Magic's the granddaddy of them all. I think there was a Star Wars collectible card game.
It was
that,
very good.
That was very very popular for quite a while.
It was very, very good.
I think there's a game called Legend of the Five Rings that I think still has quite a bit of tournament play and things like that. And then there's a World of Warcraft collectible card game, which I believe, I haven't seen too much of it as far as local game stores here.
I think it's still going.
I think it's still going, yeah. But, you know, each one of these games, other than Magic, you kind of look at it and go, I think it's still going. I think there's still a following. I'm not really sure. But, but maybe that's even another thing we can mention is that these are games that almost require a following to have game health, you know.
Yeah.
You don't really need a following for Settlers of Catan, you know. That's just it's just there. It's a good game but you need, you know, a following for these games to really stick.
Yeah, I mean, if you're doing that collectible marketing, you know, that's what makes it different from a board game. You know, you mentioned Catan. you make Catan once, or you know, you design it and put thought into it once, right, and you resell it and resell it and resell it if it's popular. With collectible games, you have to have that following. You have to have that almost social aspect of it, because you're putting out more product and you have to get the people excited for it, and you have to just kind of keep feeding them the line and keep them excited that they're going to keep buying, that they're going to have their friends keep buying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's you have to put a lot more work into the customer aspect. It's like, you know, with Catan, they don't really have to market it that much, right, you know, versus a collectible card game.
Now, we talked about collectible card games, and then sort of the next generation of things like that was the release of collectible miniatures games. Mm-hmm. So that was things like HeroClix, which I think had a huge following for a long time. I think probably still does. Again, yeah, we're kind of going, oh, I don't know, it might have a following. Yeah. and that game, the game was made by WizKids, which was, I think, sold or went out of business or something like
that.
It was sold.
I'm not sure to who.
Now it's back.
Yeah.
And they're going to be releasing some new HeroClix stuff. And so that's in that game. There was D&D miniatures, mm-hmm, Star Wars miniatures. And
Star Wars miniatures was real big around here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Had a really big following around the indie area.
And Cody and I played quite a bit of D&D miniatures, mm-hmm, when it was out. But once they shut that game down, we didn't play it anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I probably only got involved in that. I liked the gameplay well enough, but it had the side effect where, you know, even if this game goes dead, I've got all of these miniatures I can use for my game. You know, wow, I'm still using things I've bought when we played in a D&D game. And that's, to me, that's one of my trepidations into going into collectible things. Like, well, what am I going to do with all of these cards, miniatures, ships, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm just kind of a bunch of these and, you know, nothing to show for it.
That's almost kind of the fear, is that once the game dies out, you will now have all this obsolete junk, basically, right, that you can't play with. Whereas with board games or role-playing games or whatever, I mean, the stuff holds up for a lot longer.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of, you know, do you want to, you know, going back to the Catan example, you know, if it dies out, it dies out, I guess, you know, but it's probably going to stay pretty current. With collectible games, you can make a lot more money because you're infusing the market, you know, every few months. But if it becomes unpopular and it crashes, then your whole foundation is gone. You know, yeah, people aren't going to want to play old sets. You know, they'll just stop playing and move on to something else.
Yeah. It's been amazing to see the big releases of these kinds of games at Gen Con, especially.
Yeah, there's one every year.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, I think 3 or 4 years ago when Dreamblade came, mm-hmm, out. This was a collectible miniatures game from Wizards of the Coast that actually I think is a pretty great game as far as the way it was designed. It had a battle aspect to it, but it also had kind of a magic aspect where you had different spells and abilities on your guys. But it also had kind of a chess aspect, yeah, to it, where you were trying to strategically move your guys around so that they were positioned on this board. And I have a big bucket full of Dreamblade stuff, mm-hmm, that never gets played.
Hecatomb, you remember that?
Hecatomb was, yeah, another big collectible card game. Axis and Allies miniatures.
They're still turning up in swag
I
bags.
I just got a starter kit for Axis and Allies miniatures in my swag bag at Origins, you know?
Yeah, so there'll be something this year that's the flash in the pan.
Sure. Well, Arcane Legions last year was a game that... And I have no idea about how the health of that game. Yep. All I know is that every time I go in my game store, there's a big pile of Arcane Legion stuff that doesn't ever seem to get any smaller. Mm-hmm. So, you know, who knows what's going on with that. So, I mean, the reason why we kind of brought this topic up is, you know, what do we think about these games? You know, are they worthwhile to pursue? Because it seems like there's some risk involved that's not involved in a board game.
Right. I think if you have a group that you want to play with, you kind of have to first, you know, let's use Magic as an example.
Mm-hmm.
You have to kind of pick the tier you want to go into. Do you want to, are you kind of going it alone or going it with maybe just one other person and you want to do the Friday night Magic events or the casual tournament play, you know, like the sealed deck stuff or whatever, drafts. Then you have to kind of realize what you're getting into. You're like, well, I'm going to have to probably spend X amount of dollars and stay current on the rules and the tournament scene and yada, yada, yada. And the other kind of avenue you can pick, and this is something my group and I were kind of testing out here, is, you know, I sent out an email to a bunch of my friends that used to play Magic, and I'm like, you know, look, you know, we haven't played Magic in a while. I think it would be fun. It's still a good game. We got out of it for various reasons. You know, dust off your old decks, or maybe just get a pre-con deck, and we'll try it out again. We'll just play it and see if it sticks again.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a good attitude to take with those kind of games. It's amazing to me that games, the collectible games that I have that we've stopped playing, I mean, we just they just don't come out at all. You know, no. Like when that D&D miniatures game ended, nothing happened to my figures or my cards. They were still valid.
Yeah.
You know, we could have played a game, but we just didn't anymore. You know, and so sometimes it takes, you know, starting that conversation again of, hey, this was a good game. There's no reason why we can't play. It's almost like we've been fooled into thinking we can't play these games because they're obsolete now. But that doesn't mean they're not a good game. And Magic's a great example. And I think that Wizards of the Coast recognizes this, that there's a whole market that they're not tapping into. You know, they got their bread and butter of their tournament players that are always going to be buying every new thing that comes out. But I think they want to try to get some other folks into the pool here, either players who have lapsed players who don't play anymore, and then new folks as well. So they've come out with, I think, probably three or four products recently that are more conducive to casual play.
It's so much easier to learn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember, you know, when I learned, that was right around the fourth edition kind of Ice Age area. And I remember just the starter decks had this little card-sized rule book that was a really thick and had itty-bitty type and was impossible to understand.
It was like staple bound, right?
Yeah.
Like a little book. Yeah.
And it was back then, you really had to have someone teach you.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's easy. Even now, it's easier if someone teaches you how to play. But I mean, they've got video tutorials online, and the game's been streamlined and tweaked enough to where, you know, I could pick it up now.
Yeah, when you get one of these more casual play sets now, it comes with this huge poster-sized thing that walks through all the steps, and it's very, very user-friendly to get folks in. So, you know, we've recently tried a couple of these new variations on Magic, one of them being Plane Chase, which we've talked about in previous episodes, that is a kind of a multiplayer format where multiple people can play. And they have a regular deck of cards plus this plane chase deck or planar deck that represent kind of locations that you're at. And it kind of levels the playing field a little bit for people who have really powerful decks. And it can be a really fun way to casually play with a group of people. Because one downside to Magic sometimes is that it's meant to be mainly a one-on-one game, a two-player game. You can play it multiplayer, but a lot of times it ends up being, you know, two people gang up on one person.
Right.
And so the plane chase format, I think, really kind of levels that out. And recently we played a new version of the game that just came out a few weeks ago called Arch Enemy. Cody, why don't you tell us a little bit about how Arch Enemy works?
Yeah, the idea behind Arch Enemy is that it's meant for multiple players, and with the idea that one player plays as the arch enemy.
The bad guy.
The bad guy. They have a special pre-constructed deck. I mean, I assume you could play it with any deck you want, but the deck they built for it is a powerful one and is meant to go with the scheme cards. More on that in a minute. So you have, you know, you have the arch enemy with his deck, and you have all of the other players, which are on a team against the arch enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not like in the two-headed giant variant where they share a life total. They're still independent players, but they all take a turn at the same time. They can share information freely. They can show, like, look at my hand. What do you think? You know, they all attack as one. They draw as one, et cetera, et cetera. The arch enemy, to balance that, have these oversized cards. If you ever played the old Vanguard expansion, it's similar to that. Plane Chase has the large cards as well, that are schemes. And every turn, most every turn, they're going to be revealing a new scheme. Now, this could be anything from put a 4/6 artifact creature token into play, or draw three cards, put as many land cards as you get into play immediately, keep the rest, take another turn.
Draw X number of cards, and then you have no maximum hand size this turn. So
yeah, pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah.
And you know, the arch enemy will pretty much get a new one of those every turn. There's certain ongoing schemes that are pretty powerful. So the arch enemy has a lot of help here in this deck, and then he goes after the opponents as he sees fit. They all have 20 life as per Magic standard. Arch enemy starts with 40 life. I've played it with 2 and 3 opponents, and it seems pretty balanced both ways. It's about a 50-50 split in arch enemy wins and losses.
And that's a really good balance, really.
Yeah, it was funny that the first game of this we played with members of my group, again, this is the first time they've played Magic in a few years. You know, they're kind of seeing if they want to get back into it. I was the arch enemy, and I drew really well. I probably got the best schemes and starting hand and first couple draws that I could, and I just decimated the players. Mm-hmm. And then the one guy's like, "Well, that's why I don't play anymore." And I'm just like,
Just wait.
So I found, and we were playing War Machine at the same time. You know, some people were playing War Machine in the other room. We played 8 or 9 games of this, and, wow. And I found the trick was getting the new players, the person who just come in the room to play as the archenemy.
Oh, okay.
And they're like, oh, this is really cool. And so,
look at you, that was very clever.
So we found that, you know, these casual sets that Wizards has put out, you know, archenemy. This kind of eased us back into the game instead of just us taking our decks and be like, okay, let's play. You know, this gave a focus to it and kind of a way to do it. And there's 4 different ones you can get based on, you know, which kind of flavor you like.
Yeah, they're kind of fun themes. The one I have is
Scorch
called,
the World with Dragonfire. Yeah,
Assemble the Doomsday Machine.
Yeah, you know, it's neat. It's like you're fighting this, you know, this big force and you're teaming up with people. It's a neat little variant.
You know, so I think to sort of wrap up our discussion here about the just collectible stuff in general, I think that these games really do get a bad rap. You know, one thing we didn't even really hit on too much is the whole blind purchase thing. I mean, that's really kind of a hallmark of collectible games, is that a lot of times you don't know what you're getting in these booster packs or, you know, the boxes of miniatures or whatever.
Yeah.
And that can be kind of a downside too. It seems like the one of our main concern here, that a lot of people have, is really the, I feel like I'm being sold, you know, I feel like I'm being sold a bad bill of goods by a shyster, you know, and so one way I think to get around this is to try some of these casual formats for something like Magic. You know, we will really herald Magic as, you know, it's probably, if we included it, collectible card games in our list, it would be in my top 11 games by far.
Same here. Yep.
And so I think that if you've ever seen on a website or gone to a convention and seen games like this, like Magic or like Dreamblade or, you know, the Pirates of the Spanish Main, yep, the little pirate ship game, you know, and you look at that and you say, oh, that looks pretty cool. Oh, wait, it's collectible. Don't necessarily let that be the thing that keeps you from at least trying it, you know?
Right.
You know, especially things that are defunct and aren't really played that much anymore. You can probably get a real good deal online for some of these products.
Oh, yeah.
And if you get a group of folks together, again, with the social contract in place of we're going to spend this much or we're going to do this, we're going to play it this way, you can really find some great games. I think these are really good games.
Yep.
What do you think?
Yeah, I would echo what you said. Don't let the collectability scare you off. Just make sure that everyone in your group, I just want to reinforce that kind of social contract idea, make sure you're all on the same page and don't be afraid to start slow. Like I said, if they've played Magic before, in the case of my group, you know, don't worry about, oh, is this all, you know, edition legal and everything, you know. Bring the guy that has the 4th edition cards, or bring the guy that has the newer cards. Let's just play it out. You know, they're pretty balanced against each other. You know, they pay guys good amount of money to make sure that cards stay balanced. So just go in and have fun and, you know, kind of put blinders on to the tournament scene and everything. If you're not going to do it, don't do it. You don't need to worry about that. So
yeah,
just have fun, play the game.
And one more plug real quick for Arch Enemy. We played a game of this with a new friend of mine from work who had some really old cards, mm-hmm, from like the mid 90s,
yeah,
and had decks that he put together. And so we had that deck, and then Cody had a Duel of the Planeswalkers deck, which is, it's basically Magic, the card game, got turned into a video game on Xbox, which then they turned back into a card game,
yep,
with pre-con decks. And so a brand new kind of a deck versus with an old deck versus the arch enemy, it played great.
Yeah.
I mean, it was balanced, it was fun, and we all understood what we were talking about. So, you know, give some of these games a try. You know, broaden your horizons and try something that maybe you've never checked out before.
Absolutely.
All right, well, that is our big deal. Well, let's move on to, what are we talking about in Bajorad and I?
Well, Founding Fathers.
Oh, yes, a very non-collectible idea.
That's right.
All right.
Buy, try, or deny.
Game reviews for the common gamer.
It's that simple.
In 1787, I'm told, our Founding Fathers did agree to write a list of principles for keeping people free. The USA was just starting out, a whole brand new country. And so our people spelled it out, the things that we should be. And they put those principles down on paper and called it the Constitution. And it's been helping us run our country ever since then. The first part of
all right, it is Buy, Try, or Deny. And as John mentioned, we have a game that we are both very excited about, being American history nerds and fans of good games. Founding Fathers looks like it could be a nice mesh of both, but how can we really be sure until John tells us?
Wow, that was an incredibly awesome intro.
Thank you.
So Founding Fathers is another game that's in sort of the same line as 1960, The Making of the President, Campaign Manager 2008, these great sort of political and historical games from Christian Lenhard and Jason Matthews. And this one is produced by Jolly Rogers Games. It's for 3 to 5 players and plays in about, I would say, 60 to 90 minutes.
Sounds about right.
And it's a very interesting game. The game is about the Constitutional Convention, and this is after the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the Revolutionary War. Now the nation of the new fledgling American nation needs to put together a constitution and figure out what kind of government we're going to have. And so this game sort of represents the convention and the delegates coming forth and voting on different articles and debating and things like that. So, and it's all kind of done with these very interesting mechanics on this board. So I won't give you a full history of the Constitutional Convention. I will say that in the rule book for this game, there is an extensive amount of detail as far as history. So one of the real positive things about this game is that from the moment you open up the rule book, I mean, the first 2 pages gives you a whole history of the Constitutional Convention, who was there, how things went. And so, I mean, if you're like a teacher or so, like a history teacher, I'll already say that this game is a buy because you'll be able to teach your kids a lot of history just through the rule book, if nothing else. So the idea in the game is that it's a victory point game at its core, and you're going to earn points for playing certain delegates in the assembly room that's part of the board. You're going to earn points for being part of debates and things like that. And then, of course, the cards themselves that you're using to play might generate points just based upon special events that are on the cards. So it's a kind of a card-driven game. There is a game board that has these very... It kind of represents the assembly hall where the Constitutional Convention occurred. And so it's broken up into several sections. There's an assembly room. And that's the main area where the votes are going to be cast, the yay and the nay votes for different articles of the Constitution. Then there's the committee room, which is where another smaller group of people are going to be discussing another article of the Constitution and determining whether that's going to be added or not. So the committee room and the assembly room are both areas where these articles are going to be voted on. You have the debate floor. There's 4 main factions in this game. There's Signar, Kador, and there's the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. And then there is the small states supporters and the large state supporters. And so these are the large states are at odds with the small states, and the Federalists are, of course, at odds with the Anti-Federalists. So you can debate in one section of the game board on these particular positions. And then there's also going to be a track next to the assembly room to show the voting record and what states have voted for and against particular articles. And so you have little tokens for yay and nay that's going to keep track of that. And then also on the board, there's a scoring track, and then there's like a draw pool where the cards are going to come from. So in this game, you're actually going to be sort of taking on the role of one of these founding fathers. And there's 5 to choose from. There's Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, William Patterson, Roger Sherman of Connecticut. William Patterson's from New Jersey. And Charles Pinckney of South Carolina.
Oh, my.
And so the 5 of these are the ones that you can choose from. They in the rules sort of indicate for like a 3-player game, they tell you which 3 would be the best ones to play and so forth. So, and so you're going to get a player reference board that has that particular guy on it. Every component in this game, the cards and these reference boards, it's just full of information. So, you know, it's a very historical. So all these player reference boards have a huge paragraph explaining, telling about this particular founding father's life. And so it's just really rich as far as that content in the game. It's really, really cool. You're going to have 12 articles of the Constitution, which are represented by these big chunky cardboard pieces, big tokens. And they're going to either represent what's called a historical side or the ahistorical or non-historical side. So historical side will have a particular icon on it showing like a Federalist position or an Anti-Federalist position. And then it'll have like, you know, the article as it's written in the actual Constitution. On the other side, you have the opposite opinion. So the Federalist one would have an Anti-Federalist leaning. And then you would have written on there kind of an opposite or a different alternate version of history version of that article.
They all have goatees and scars.
No, there's no pictures on these. Just writing. And really, the writing that's on them, that's in the very scripty, you know, like the Constitution, the writing doesn't really matter. What you really care about is that icon for the faction. That's what you're really kind of going for there. And then also, if it's historical, it'll just be that faction icon. If it's non-historical or ahistorical, it'll have kind of an orange ring around it to show that it's like bizarro world. So there's those articles that you're going to be debating over. Every player is going to get some influence markers, and these are big, chunky wooden blocks that are in the player color that have stickers on them. And you have to put the stickers on the blocks to begin with. So I'll go ahead and just start by saying that the components in this game I think are very pretty. The artwork is cool, and you know, it's, of course, it's historical artwork, so it's like portraits of these guys, these actual men who lived. And the artwork I think is very cool for the assembly room. I did not find the component quality to be stellar.
Yeah, it looks like pretty at first.
Yeah, and you know, like, and when I went to go and put the stickers on the influence markers, I had a real hard time getting the stickers to come off of the paper. You know, I had to get like the fingernail out there to try to, you know, peel them back and all that kind of stuff. It was to the point where I was almost ready to write the publisher and say, "Oh, there's something wrong with my stickers." And I was finally able to kind of get a thumbnail in to, you know, peel them back. And the board that I got has a bit of a split in it, you know, like a little seam split, you know, so it was just a little bit disappointing. It could just be that was just the very first run. I got one of the very first copies hot off the presses. So don't take that too much to heart there. But and then the cards themselves, the game comes with 55 delegate cards. And each one of these represents an actual delegate from the Constitutional Convention. And these cards do all the different stuff in the game. And much like a lot of the other designs by Leonard and Matthews, these are multi-purpose cards. You can do several things with them. And that's kind of the core of the game. And really a lot of the fun of the game is being able to make your choices of those cards. The cards are pretty. They have good artwork on them. The card stock quality is really low. Like, yeah, they're really flimsy. I just, you know, I got to make mention of that because that was just a little bit disappointing.
You going to sleeve them?
I could. I'm not sure if that'll really help that much as far as, because it's not like they're shiny. Like, I don't think they're going to get nicked up or dog-eared or anything. They're just really thin. I'm afraid they're going to get bent or creased. But like I said, real pretty and nice artwork on them. And this is sort of a semi-secret game as far as your hand, because you have a hand of cards, and so you'll have the particular delegate in your hand, and their state, and then their special ability. But then on the back of the card, other players will actually be able to see what state that delegate's from, and also the faction icon. So it's sort of and that's important in the game to be able to kind of read what other people are doing. So that, you know, that's kind of what you're going to get. You have a scoring marker that you'll, you know, in your player color that you'll stick on the scoring track, and you'll start off with three of these influence markers. There's a total of eight in your color, but you'll start off with three, and you might be able to gain more during the game. So you're going to start off the game with four cards in your hand, and you're going to start with three cards in your hand, and one of those cards is the card for your founding father. That's, you know, kind of your guy. So if you're Hamilton, you'll have an Alexander Hamilton card, and then you'll get two other cards, and you'll have the starting hand of three cards for your delegates. And then the first thing that you're going to do is you're going to take the first two articles off the article pile on their historical side. You're going to put one of them in the assembly room to be up for a vote, and one of them in the committee room to be up for debate in the committee, I guess. And then the game is going to start. The sequence of play, what you can do on your turn, is very, very simple. And the first thing that you can do on your turn is you can declare a vote. And declaring a vote is basically just laying down a delegation from a particular state and saying, I'm voting yes, or I'm voting yay, or I'm voting nay. And by delegation, that's going to be one or more cards that are all from the same state. And so, you know, it may just be one. If you just have one guy from New Hampshire and you want to make that vote, then you can lay that down and say, yeah, New Hampshire votes no. But if you have more than one, then that might be of benefit to you to have more delegates from that particular state. Now, the other thing to keep in mind when you're making these votes and laying down these cards is that you have to pay attention to what's called faction bias. And that means that whatever faction is represented by the article that's up for debate, like if you have a Federalist faction marker on the article, that would mean that the Federalists would want to vote in favor of that, and the Anti-Federalists would want to vote against it. That means that if you have a Federalist delegate, you can't vote against that. You can't go against, you know, what your faction would normally do. Now, if you are a small state or a large state proponent, you don't really care one way or the other about the Federalist or Anti-Federalist position. So you could vote either way. So you just have to make sure that you're not voting against what your faction says that you can vote. But you'll just lay down that card, and, you know, there's little spaces that look like tables, and you just lay them down in one place and then put one of your influence markers on top of it and just say that you're casting your vote. Once you've cast your vote for a particular state, then no one else can cast a vote for that state, except if they cast a delegation that has more cards than the one that you laid down. So if you put two New Hampshire guys down for nay, then in order for them to be displaced, someone else would have to play three New Hampshire cards in the opposite side. You'd have to vote the opposite position. So that's kind of tricky to do. I think we only had that happen a couple times in our game where people got displaced.
One of the tricks is, and this is the same with like 1960, is that you're not only playing these cards in opposition, you're also, you know, by playing them, you're not able to use their special ability, which John will get into in a little bit later.
Right, right.
But, you know, you're losing more than just a vote there. You're losing a lot of potential power.
Right. And Cody makes a good point that in each of these cards have multiple things they can do. And one of the other things that you can do with your card is to speak out in debate. And so the debate track has basically these four little almost kind of racetracks that go from one to seven spaces. And what you're going to do if you want to speak in debate is to discard a one or more of these delegates. But this time you don't care so much about where their factions are as far as the yay or the nay for the assembly room. Now you're going to discard guys who have the same faction in order to speak out in debate. So if you have two Federalist guys, you can lay them down. I'm kind of getting on. I'm talking about the Federalists a lot.
Yeah.
If you have two Anti-Federalist guys and you discard them, then you can take your influence marker and move two spaces on the Anti-Federalist debate track.
States' rights, baby.
The idea is that at the end of the turn, whoever has advanced the farthest down each of these tracks is going to get a special token of that particular faction. And then at the end of the game, you're going to get points based upon who has the most of each faction token, who has the most of those, and then how many points you get is going to be based upon which articles get passed and what the faction is for those articles. So there's this weird interplay where you're trying to speak in debate to get these tokens, but then you're also trying to influence the vote so that the things that get passed will match with the faction tokens that you've gotten in debate.
So your tokens aren't worthless.
So your tokens aren't worthless, yeah. Easier said than done. It's really kind of a tricky little dance you have to play with that.
Much like politics, John.
Oh my goodness.
Much like politics.
Yeah, exactly right. So you can declare a vote, you can speak in debate. Third thing that you could do on your turn is you can enact an event, and each one of these delegate cards has a special event that you can enact on it. This would be very similar if you're familiar with 1960 or Twilight Struggle. You could play a card for the event and you just do whatever the text of it says. The thing I love about the events in this game is that they all have to do, they're very much tied to the person that's on the card. So to their personality or to something that they did during the convention. And so you can learn a little bit about these people and you know what they did in the convention by their special events. And there's two kinds of events. There's things that just trigger immediately and will allow you to, there's all kinds of things that they do. Right. I mean, you might get points based upon what kind of cards you already have in your hand. You might be able to declare a vote that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to declare. Lots of different things. And then there's also some events that have a little sun symbol on them, and those are ongoing events, kind of like an enchantment magic that just sits on the table. And, you know, it might be something like, no other players may play events for the rest of the turn.
Yeah.
You know,
something annoying usually.
Really annoying, yeah. So it can really mess up your strategy if you've been planning on playing cards a particular way. I think there is even also one that says that nobody may speak out in debate for the rest of the turn. I think Cody's favorite was George Washington.
Yeah, George Washington, His Excellency George Washington. When he comes in, and if you play him for the event, the vote ends immediately. So if there's more yays than nays, then it passes. If it's tied or if there's more nays, it ends. And man, I got that card twice because you cycle through the deck. And that can be really powerful, because if you're like, man, I can get an early lead, but I don't know if I can close this out. You get that early lead, and GW walks in, and bam.
Yeah, and you might be trying to slow play your strategy, mm-hmm. and then that comes in, and it just blows it out of the water there. So that's kind of a fun thing too. Now, the last thing that you can do in your turn, you're going to just choose one of these things. The last thing that you can do is to snub delegates. Like, if you just don't like cards that are in your hand, you can just discard as many of those as you want, and then you're going to draw back up to your hand size, which is usually 3. And the way that the card selection happens is that you have a deck, your face down draw deck, and then you're going to have 3 cards that are laid out on the board face down, and that's what your draw pool that you can choose from, and that's replenished at the end of each person's turn. The other thing is that if your founding father's card ever comes up on top of the draw deck, you immediately get that card.
Only so James Madison can be James Madison.
That's right. So if you're the James Madison player and that card comes up, that goes immediately to you. And the special ability for each of the founding fathers, for the players, is that you can discard it to get an additional influence token. So this is the way that over the course of the game you can build influence tokens. So the round is going to end. You're going to just continue doing this and playing your influence markers and casting your votes. And the round will end either when George Washington comes out and does his event.
I'm tired of this crap.
Or it's going to end when there are either 7 yay votes, in which case the article will pass, or 6 nay votes, in which the article will fail. And at that point, then everything stops, and then you're going to score. And you're going to score the delegates that have voted based upon whether they won or not. And so are going to give 1 point for each delegate card that was played on the winning side. So even if it was a nay vote, if the article was struck down, then all of those folks are going to get 1 point per delegate. If you happen to have a faction symbol on the delegate card that matches the faction symbol that was up for debate, then you're going to get 2 points. So that's only going to happen if you're on the yay side of the equation. So if it was a Federalist thing and you had Federalist guys, then you'll get 2 points for those cards. Now, the other thing is that you're only going to get points for these cards if you have an influence marker on top of that delegation. Because during the game, you only have 3 to start off with, and you might have way more things that you want to do. And once you've placed a delegation down, you start off with that influence marker on it. But then after, on a later turn, if you want to do something else like speak and debate or something like that, you can move your influence marker off of that delegation to go have him go and do something else. But then you lose the points for those cards. The points won't go to anybody. The vote will stay there, but you won't get any points. So then after all of those votes are scored, of course, the folks that lost get nothing. You get nothing. but you do get something. And all of the influence markers that were on the losing side, all of those are going to now go into the committee room, and they'll go off into the committee room. And then you're going to count who has the most influence markers in the committee room. Now, as you go into future rounds, there may actually be guys in the committee room before the vote ends. There's some events that will cause you to put influence markers into there. So then you're going to count up, and whoever has the most, they are going to decide what the outcome is for that article that's in the committee room. Is it going to stay historical? Is it going to flip to the non-historical side? And again, you're making these decisions sort of based upon how well you've done in the debates, and are you getting those tokens that are going to match up with the ones that have the most, that have been passed the most. Again, a very strange dance that you have to do with that. You're also going to get a point for every guy that you have in the committee room. The person who has the most influence markers in the committee room will get to remove them and take them back into their play area. Everybody else has to stay there, and they just will sit in the committee room.
Languish,
yeah. Until they're maybe removed in a later turn by, when you decide to move them around. So that is pretty much how you'll score the assembly room and then the committee room. So every round, 2 articles are going to get passed, and then you'll put those to the side of the board. Then after you have done the scoring on the committee room, then you're going to resolve the debates. And whoever is farthest along on this track, like I said, will get a token for that particular faction. After that's done, then you'll take back those influence tokens to your play area.
It's important to note on the event of a tie that nobody wins.
Ah, good point, yeah.
Because that you can easily play spoiler. If you don't think you can win, you can at least force a tie and then nobody gets it.
Right. So that's another strategy too. And then once everything has been sort of doled out, then you will bring two more articles on their historical side to the committee room and then to the assembly room. And then you'll continue on and play. You're going to play four rounds of the game. And then after those four rounds are done, you're going to do a final scoring. It's one thing to note that I don't think I mentioned before is that there are 12 total articles. You're going to be debating and voting on 8 of them. But then there are 4 of them that will actually start out on the side of the board as kind of like priming the pump. Yeah. It's a random mix of things that have already started. So you'll be able to look immediately and see, you know, which debate track do I want to kind of go down here? Because this is what's already on the board, what's already been passed. So you're going to, at the end of the fourth round, you'll finish up your scoring on all of those articles and the assembly room and the delegates and all that kind of stuff. And then you're going to look at all of the articles that have been passed. And, you know, you're going to see what is the first place faction. And then whoever has the most tokens of that faction is going to get 5 points. And then, you know, which is the second place faction, has the second most number of articles passed. Then that person is going to get 4 points. The third place faction will get 3 points. And whoever has the most tokens for the fourth place faction will get 2 points. Now, that's the scoring that I'm reading from the rule book. The scoring is actually different on the reference card.
Yeah.
So I don't know which one is right, but it's one of those two. Just flip a coin. And then you're just going to basically add up your score, and then that's the end of the game there. So it's very interesting. It's thematic.
Yes, definitely.
But it's also a little bit abstract, I think, in the way that you're dealing with the strategy of it. So anyway, as we've said before, our review strategy here, if we're talking about strategy, is to give you buy points, try points, and deny points about a game, and then give you kind of our overall rating. So we'll start with buy points for Founding Fathers. I've been talking a whole bunch, so why don't you talk a little bit, Cody? What are your buy points for Founding Fathers?
As I mentioned earlier, and this is a personal buy point, the fact that it's based on American history, and especially the Revolutionary period, big buy with me. I love that period of history, and I love studying it. More general buy points is that this is a pretty, 60 to 90 minutes is pretty close to the mark. And if everyone's familiar with the game, it's more closer to the 60 minutes thing.
Yeah.
And with the decisions you're making and the strategy involved, it's a nice feeling because you feel like you've played a heavier game, but without the time expenditure. Like after we got done playing, I'm like, boy, you know, I really felt we played kind of a heavy-ish game, but boy, you know, that only took an hour and a half, you know, that was nothing. I think they do a good job. There's a lot of abstract strategy, but the way they theme it and how they integrate into the game, it's hard to see the seam lines there, I guess. It's pretty well integrated, I think. The art on the components is very good. The quality is a little so-so, but, you know, the box looks good, things like that. And I think it's a really deep game. I think once you get multiple plays in with the same people, you know, you can see a lot of little nuances come out, and I think it has the capability to really grow in the depth department. So those are my buy points, John.
Yes, I will agree with just about everything that you said. I think that the richness of the theme and the American history theme is just so, it's painted on so nicely, and there's just so much that you can learn. The rule book itself, all of the cards, you know, even if you look in the very back of the rule book, it gives you full biographies of all the people that are on the cards. I mean, it's you know, they've devoted out of the, you know, 17 or 18 pages of the rule book, probably about half of it is just history mm-hmm. book, you know. And so if you like that kind of thing, then that's going to be a real big buy point for you. And you know, I think that the strategy element is cool, in that, like you said, you're not taking that much time to really have kind of a deep game experience. And so I think it's a really good game because it's one that you can just pull out. I don't think you don't have to make it an event game. You don't have to say, hey, let's have some folks over to play Founding Fathers. It's something you could just pull out and just say, hey, I got this new game, want to try it. And you can teach the rules and be up and running, you know, in 15 minutes probably. Right. So that's a real big buy point. What about try points?
Kind of riffing on the other side of the American history thing. If you have someone that is really not interested at all in American history or in that time period, I think the theme is almost a detriment there, because some games it's easy to ignore the theme. Like, it may be easy to ignore a fantasy theme and something. This game, it's almost so well layered and so put into the game itself that it could be off-putting to someone who just has no interest for that. So I would say know your crowd there. I mean, I think the game can speak for itself if you can just get them playing, but you know, it's just so immersed in it that some people may have a problem with it. And then I'll mention the components again. We both decided, you know, we don't want to make this a component-heavy thing, but no. I'm thinking this may be a first print run issue, but with the errors in the book versus the card and some of just the subpar printing, let's hope this is a first edition issue, because I think that detracts both from the cost of the game and the experience of the game.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's not a deny point. I mean, it's not a reason not when the game is on the table and you're playing it, it looks great. You know, it really does. But just a few of those little niggling details as far as that goes. I think that one thing that might be a kind of a try point is that it took me a couple of games to figure out what the heck I was doing. The mechanics themselves are easy. You know, you only have four things you can do in your turn. It's really easy to make one of four decisions. But it's real hard to figure out when the best time is to play certain things. And that play, like we mentioned, between the debate track and those tokens and the articles and the committee room and knowing when you what side of the issue you want to be on. You know, do you want to be on the winning side to get the points for your delegates? Or do you really want to be on the losing side so you can influence what's in that committee room and get a few points there? It's really tricky, I think. And yeah, so
we kind of ignored debates early on, and then we're like, oh crap, we really need to get on this.
Yeah. So it's kind of hard to know what to do, and it might take you a couple of plays to really get that under your belt. And if you're someone who's prone to analysis paralysis, I don't think this is the worst. This isn't really a bad game for that, but it could be if you're kind of going to really agonize over your decision. Then I think that might make the game a lot longer. Any deny points for this one?
One of my favorite political figures is John Adams, and since he wasn't at the Constitutional Convention, he's not at this in this game. So
he'll be in the expansion.
That's right. He'll be in the France and Holland expansion. But yeah, so that's a downer. But that's all I got.
Yeah, I don't really have any negatives so much for this game. I think it's a really good game, and it's really cool to see. To see this level of detail of American history really brought to the forefront, I think it's really cool.
I agree.
So that's Founding Fathers. So our overall rating.
Oh.
Your overall rating.
Yeah. I hate going back to these old things. You know, it's a try plus, because I really think the theme can make or break this game for you. I mean, I think if you really don't have an interest in this, you shouldn't buy it. It's a good game, but I think the theme will just not be interesting to you, and you'll kind of check out after a while. But it is a good game.
Yep. I think it falls squarely in the middle. It's like the absolute middle of the road try.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's a total buy. I mean, I was one of the ones running into the dealer hall at Origins to get it on that day. But it's just right up my alley. But I think for just the average gamer, it's going to fall right in the middle. I think that, you know, if you don't like the theme, you're going to hate it. If you like the theme, then you might like it.
Yeah.
So, it falls right in the middle there for me. So that's Founding Fathers. All right, well, I was trying to think of something, you know.
We the people need to close out the show.
Oh, yeah, there you go. All right, well, let's close the show out. Into the present day. Now we've gone through the articles 1 through 7. We went kind of fast, so if you have any questions, go back to the top, even make your own edits a couple of times through. I know you're going to get it. What does the Constitution do? What does the Constitution say? Listen up and I'll tell you about the Constitution. What does the Constitution do? What does the Constitution say? Listen up and I'll tell you about the Constitution. Well, thanks again for listening to another episode of Game On with Cody and John. We invite you again to check out our new website at gameonpodcast.com. It's pretty.
I like it. You can check out all of the bells and whistles there, links to our guild, donation button, friends of the show. Definitely check that out. And as announcer guy, Wayne's going to tell you as we exit a myriad of ways to contact us. See what Indeed. I did there? See what yep. I did there? So we got
Gen Con coming up in just a few weeks here. We hope to see a lot of you there. Please come up and say hi to us if you see us. And you know, we'll be back in 3 weeks to give you a great coverage of the convention and a lot more great Game On content. So, hey, until then,
Game On.
This episode of Game On is sponsored by Myriad Games on behalf of friendly professional game stores everywhere. If you'd like to contact Cody and John, send them an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com or leave a voicemail at 413-8-GAME-ON. For more content, check out our website at gameonpodcast.com. Join our guild on BoardGameGeek.com and connect with other fans of the show. Become a fan of our show on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Game On Podcast. Game On with Cody and John is a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network. Check out other great shows on PulpGamer.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, Game On!